Hi everyone, and welcome to SciDance Podcast Season 3. I'm your host, Jasmine Cook. This is a dance science podcast presenting discussions with global industry leaders, aiming to make research and information more accessible and enhance dancer well-being, health and training at all levels of the sector. New episodes every Monday, 6 a.m. London time. SciDance thanks Ballet Rosa for sponsoring today's episode. Ballet Rosa inspires dancers from all over the world with apparel and accessories for male and female dancers, designed using the highest quality materials and engineered for a high level of comfort, mobility, and performance. Ballet Rosa is renowned in the world of dance for their harmonious mastery of technical materials combined with artistically inspired design. Check them out and find out more at www.balletrosa.com. Hi everyone, and welcome back to SciDance Podcast. I'm really excited to be here today, and I'm so excited that we got this episode in as well because we so nearly didn't get a chance to record it. I'm here with Layla. I'll let her introduce herself. Welcome, Layla. How are you today?
Hello, Jasmine. Thank you very much for inviting me for this podcast. I've been listening to it for a year and a half. I've listened to many, many episodes and recommended it to many dancers that I work with. So I'm very excited to be on this. And yes, so I have to introduce myself. So yes, I work at the Netherlands Dance Theatre. I've been at that company for 25 years, and the National Ballet, which they're for 22 years, and I work at the National Ballet Academy, somewhere in between those things. I picked that up. And then I also teach a teacher training course for people that want to become Pilates teachers. And interestingly enough, there's been quite a few dancers that I worked with at the companies that then went to take Pilates teacher training.
Yeah, I'm sure there's quite a crossover often there. So you've danced since you were quite young and kind of gone through your own dance journey, and that led you onto Pilates. Could you walk us through that timeline? So how did you start dancing? Where did you go to college? How did Pilates come into your life from there?
Yes, I started dancing when I was 5, and I didn't like it in the beginning. So I thought we had to do all this boring exercise and I just wanted to bounce around the room, and we had to stand still at the bar. And then over time, I got to do more and more advanced classes, and I really, really liked it. And my mother used to love ballet. She inspired me with some of the stories she told me about the dancers that had inspired her. And over time, I started to become serious, and I auditioned for the conservatory, and I got rejected right away without explanation at that time. They didn't used to sort of say what it is that you weren't doing well. So I went to a very good private school next to my academics. And then I started to do, Netherlands Dance Theatre started a school, which was a great school to do, but they got very focused on being thin, and I wasn't thin enough. Now I think I was actually pretty thin, but it was the 80s, and in the 80s, thin was really emaciated. So I left that school, and then I got a place at London Studio Centre, so I went to London. And there we had body conditioning on the schedule. So that was the first time I did that. Then I got injured and somebody recommended me to go to a Pilates studio. And that's really where I first experienced doing a Pilates class.
Yeah, that's great. And you mentioned as well, so that body conditioning side of it really opened up the concept of other methods outside of ballet for you being used to improve ballet. So what we now know is kind of cross training. But at the time you were like, oh my goodness, I can do these other things and this will improve my ballet training. Do you want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yes. Because my kind of own collection of training, I didn't go from A to Z, right? I sort of collected it myself. I always felt I was aware of my shortcomings. I felt I was to blame that I didn't do things well. I felt like I was fighting my body to try and be something that I wasn't. And then when I went to these Pilates classes, I felt like I could just explore what my body was doing. And because of the machines, they're so wonderful. They give you so much feedback. It opened me up to finding movement in my body, sort of releasing movement rather than working so hard. And because I had done a lot of athletics when I was young, I was very muscular. So if somebody told me to work hard, I would just tense every muscle in my body, which makes it really hard to move.
Yeah, definitely. And that aspect of movement is something I really want to look at a little bit later. Just first, so you've kind of touched on it there. Pilates was really enjoyable for you, partly because, as well, we mentioned last time, the autonomy that it gave you. So you could choose at the time when you went into Pilates what you wanted to work on that day, what you wanted to do, which is really enjoyable and kind of strikes me as very different to dance in a way. So how did that apprenticeship in your Pilates training go? How did that come about? And then what did you enjoy most about it?
Well, when I went to that studio, I didn't have money, clearly, and I couldn't afford to take those classes. And they were very generous right away. They said, well, you can become an apprentice, you can come teach here. And at that time, there were no teacher training courses in the 80s. So the apprenticeship was the way to learn. And in the old days, the Pilates classes were organized differently than today. Nowadays, people take private sessions or group performer sessions. But at that time, and still some studios in England, I know Alan Hurtman still works like that. People know their own program and they just go to the machine of their choice and start their workout. And then they kind of work through. And sometimes I would be there for 3 hours just playing with all these things and investigating, which is very different, of course, than being told from the front of the room what you have to do. Now, I must say at that time, London Studio Center allowed the students to create their own schedule. So you choose your own classes and your own teachers, which is unique. And I don't think it ever happened again. But that suited me fine. But yeah, so in the Pilates space to explore things, it was a whole different thing. And to notice how you could be specific in what you strengthen and what you lengthen, and then observe the result. I liked how that sort of triggered my analytical mind. So then I could be more part of my progress.
Yeah, totally. That's so cool that you can choose your own schedule.
It is great. They should do that all the time.
That's amazing. When we spoke last time, then you kind of started your career working with dancers, working for Pilates in the company. And you noticed, you mentioned a lot of vulnerabilities in dancers that you kind of idolized or seen on stage and thought, oh, they're flawless. But actually, when you look up close, everyone struggles with things, no matter how far in their career or their schooling they are. And I found it really interesting as well when you were talking about how it was refreshing for you and refreshing for them as well to have someone really invest the time and effort in them to help them work through all these fine movements. Can you tell us about this transition, how you kind of got that job and how you found it working with these dancers?
Yes, that's a lot of questions. I got the job because in Holland, there was no Pilates. In the mid 90s, nobody knew what that was. And somehow somebody knew. So they asked me. Very, you know, I was just lucky. And in the beginning, I was nervous, of course. I started at NDT and then as a dance theater, I had seen them perform since I was a child. And it was like impossible to teach these people. But spending time with them alone, I realized very soon that we're all just pretending, or the stage is illusion, right? So we're showing illusion. But then when you come up close and dancers allow you close, you become aware of what they have to work with and how they're often insecure. There's a lot of fear and of doing wrong, of an injury possibly ending the career. So instead of teaching them exercise, which in the beginning I thought I had to teach them Pilates, and I also teach them floor bar. And for a while I felt like they already do all day things that other people tell them to do. So what if I sit next to them and say, like, so what are your goals? What are your needs? What direction do you want to go? And then let's see what we can make up together that is useful for you. And then keep asking them, how does that feel? And that, for me, made it so much more interesting, because then with every dancer, you start on this journey. And you take that journey through. So you're not looking for a fix or a solution to a problem. You're just guiding them in that specific time in that part of their career to figure stuff out themselves. And I found that, I mean, they're adult professionals. They know what they're in for. And the more you create a safe space for them to be the adult professional that they are, the more they feel that they can take charge in their career and feel confident about their bodies. And I thought that process for me was more interesting than just teaching them the Pilates method. The Pilates method I use as a tool to achieve what I hope to achieve, but in itself, it could be something else too. It doesn't have to. I mean, I like the Pilates equipment a lot though, but you see what I mean? It's not about them being able to do the hundreds.
No, definitely. And it's about I guess that kind of leads us into, I wasn't sure where to go next, but I was just thinking about sort of the role and purpose of supplementary training. And I guess the role and purpose of it isn't always to make you stronger or to necessarily directly improve one certain aspect of your dancing. It doesn't need a goal in that way. Sometimes the goal can be more open and maybe the purpose is bigger than that. If you have any comments on that.
Well, yeah, and I think in that sense, Pilates is really nice because it's close to ballet, but it's different. And because it's supplemental training, I want to offer something that dancers do not get in their classes. So that means I make an effort to use different language, to use different examples, to use different cues than they would normally get in ballet. So to open up different way to look at their technique. And when you, I don't know if you've been on the Pilates equipment, it tends to sort of play with your orientation towards gravity. So for instance, if you do pliés, normally you'd be standing, but on the reformer, you can do them lying down, or you can do a similar movement like jumping lying down, or you could be on your front, or you could be on your side doing something that you normally do in a different orientation. So it challenges the body and it allows you to sometimes find a shortcut towards that thing that you try to work for, instead of just doing whatever it is that you're trying to work for. Like for instance, a back bend, you try to get that back bend deeper, but if you take it apart and take your time to figure out what kind of thoughts are leading that specific dancer towards the strategy that they have, then you can start being in conversation about those thoughts, showing them that maybe they've been told that they're stiff anyway. And then you can say like, well, maybe you're not. Let's have a look if you're really stiff, and let's look what movement is available. And then in that same way, it supplements ballet really, really well because it allows you time to figure stuff out. If I don't know if that is still, but I think often still is when you're in a dance class or in a rehearsal, often dancers feel pressure to deliver something even before it is asked, which means there is no time to reflect. There's little time to reflect anyway. So it's nice to offer that sort of safe space for reflection, for trying things, seeing about if it works, if it doesn't work, all of that is good. So I think it's valuable to be able to offer that during education as well as during professional life.
Yeah, totally. And I know we were talking with Markella about how Pilates offers, some people critique it because it's too close to ballet to be considered cross-training. So maybe in the typical ways of research, it's not making the adaptations that are supposedly needed to be effective in that way, but it offers so many more things. I love the consideration of time. So it's not necessarily, yeah, something that can be measured by research always. Maybe it's something that needs to be thought about and, yeah, experienced. And I think it's definitely interesting to recognize all of the benefits of it in that way.
I think in the beginning, when people started doing dance or doing Pilates in the 60s and 70s, then it was considered cross training because it was wildly new to do something next to dance, right, at that time. And then strength training came, and of course that became a whole different way to cross train, and I can see and understand how that serves a whole different purpose. But I would argue that Pilates or floor bar could offer what I would call mental cross-training, like your approach to what you're doing in ballet, the mindset that you're doing it with, the cues that you're working from, by turning them around and examining them again. In that sense, I think it's cross-training, even if maybe it's not the word for it, but you're crossing your into what they normally do and reinvestigating it. So yeah, you probably won't go with the definition of cross-training, but you're certainly doing something that is not necessarily that close to what ballet offers.
But it's
still, so you try to take them away from that.
Yeah, no, totally. I totally agree. So it's maybe Pilates maybe has a role in bridging the aesthetic demands of dance and the realistic expectations of your actual body, which you mentioned kind of earlier on when you were saying about the dancers who look so perfect and it's all an illusion, but actually they're struggling with things as well. So maybe Pilates has a role in helping people to discover this. What are the problems with people seeing it as an illusion, I guess, looking from the outside in, and how can Pilates help help with that, maybe for upcoming dancers. Yeah. Maybe that's interesting to think about.
Well, yeah, when I work with the kids in the school, they often have this idea, of course, and on this podcast, there's been often talk about how social media plays into this, that of course we're only going to see the so-called perfection or the so-called success, but it's a performing art. It's definitely an illusion what you see on stage. That arabesque seems to be completely with it straight back up, but that's not happening for sure. You need to understand, I mean, a big one is turnout. I mean, it's emphasized so much in classes that turnout is so important, that I see young students and also grown dancers being so concerned about their turnout and forcing it. Well, I asked them, what dancer do you remember that you've ever seen in your life that you go like, oh my God, that was such beautiful turnout? We don't remember people for it. It's just a tool to deliver the art form. In itself, it doesn't have that much meaning. So I think in discussing that with the kids in the school, like, what are you looking for in this perfection? What is this art form about? What is it that touches you? What performer do you like? And then see what elements are in a movement, and then look at how you could approach those elements separately, maybe if they're difficult for you, and then bring them back together. So somebody can construct their own physicality in dance rather than trying to work from an outside picture, but they can work from their inside experience.
Yeah, and I think in a way in my head, the first thing I think there is that it makes it more manageable. So instead of seeing this whole big picture, because you're breaking it down and building it up, all of a sudden it feels much less anxiety inducing, I guess. It just feels much more manageable. And in that way as well, how can working one-on-one with dancers really help that?
Well, the great advantage of working one-on-one is that you can ask how someone is doing. How does that feel for you? Like in a session of an hour, I probably ask that 10 times, which of course in a group class, if you learn ballet in a school or if you get ballet class in a company, there's way too many people to keep asking that. And if you're not asked that, you probably don't develop so much the skill of noticing how something feels. So asking it over and over again, I hope to help the dancer be able to articulate what something feels like, where they feel a certain movement, to notice, hey, where's my weight? Do you like what you're feeling, what you're noticing? Well, I think my weight should be more forward or back to have a good balance. Okay, let's try that. Now, what if you were breathing differently? Or what if you would spread your toes a little bit, you know, anchor or ground your toes more? So it's like offering options so you can self-manage yourself and become more autonomous within your dancing. And you don't need to look for the validation from the front of the room, kind of, which I've found a lot of times dancers be nervous about doing things wrong or looking for confirmation. You see, I'm weak, I can't do that very well. I'm not interested in if you're weak or if you're doing something right or if you're doing something wrong. I'm just interested in seeing how you can become the best dancer that you are. And labeling things like that, I don't see so much the value of it, because often dancers label themselves already with many negative labels. And I like to invite them to let go of that as much as possible and just look for what is available, what is possible, instead of what's wrong.
Yeah, definitely. And that kind of goes back to what I think we were just talking about Kathleen's podcast just before we started recording. I can't remember which episode it is, but it's the one, I can't remember the name, but it's the one about, oh, it's the title of her article.
It's episode 9, Why We're Still So Bad at Addressing Dancers' Mental Health. It's an excellent podcast. And yeah, exactly, she talks about this. So it's like precisely that.
Yeah. So the validation from the front of the room instead of feeling things for yourself, and it all leads in. Yeah, so especially something I want to really look at today, is something I find really interesting myself, so a little bit selfish, but one-on-one training can kind of, can really enhance the results of cueing. So cueing is something that, yeah, I'm personally really interested in. I guess when you work with dancers one-on-one, you find exactly what works for them and exactly what works to help them find the movements in their own body. They can really find these cues for themselves when they take them into class. Can you tell us a little bit about this?
Yes. So I need to know what their minds are working with, what kind of images they have, what kind of self-cueing, self-talk they're doing. So I often see somebody probably putting their feet in too much turnout, and then they're rolling their foot in, and then they're lifting their arches because you're not allowed to roll your feet in, and then they have a problem with their feet. And so you go like, so what are you doing with your feet? Well, I'm lifting my arches. Why are you lifting your arches? Well, because I shouldn't roll my feet. So why do you think your feet are rolling? And then over time, they'll figure out that it is because their thighs are actually not turning out and they don't know how to access their deeper rotator. So we start working on the rotators. We start working on becoming very aware of the articulation of the thigh bone in the hip socket. And then over time, they notice that they can stand on their feet without rolling and they don't have to worry about lifting the arch because it's arranged from higher up in the body. So this is just an example where you go like, what belief system is that student working from and or a dancer, and how can we come to a more efficient learning pattern? And you have to understand, working at Netherlands Dance Theater National Ballet, I've worked with dancers from probably every school in the world, I don't know, but at least from many different schools. So in this book, I'm generalizing a little bit in this podcast, but I'm not referring to any school in particular. It's just a general picture that I tend to see. That the cueing, once you have to take your time to go towards experiencing what happens with the dancer and then asking what they feel, it becomes a different thing from them than just like responding in a reflex to a cue. Many cues are used so often, pull up, stretch your knee, stretch your foot. We've heard them so often that the response is a reflex. And it doesn't allow us to go like, what actually do I want to do when I point my foot? Or when actually is my knee straight, especially when you have bending knees? When do we decide the leg is straight? So going into that conversation with them and seeing how they respond to it can create a language between the dancer and myself to start building a movement pattern that suits their needs better, and that they can take into ballet class and to rehearsal.
Yeah, definitely. And I think that's something that maybe, I did my undergrad dissertation on cueing, like attentional focus. And I think a lot of the research, and I definitely didn't think about this at the time, but a lot of the research doesn't consider the impact that, so if someone said pull up your knees your whole life, then maybe that just washes over the dancer. Whereas if they stop and think, where is the dancer at this point in their training and what are they feeling at this point and what cues they need at this point, I think if research considered that, there might be very different kind of outcomes of that. Does that make sense? Have I explained that?
Yes. And then there's another component to that. For instance, you've been told your feet don't point very well. So, you know, when you're young already, I mean, this you find out very soon, right? That people consider your feet to be stiff. So any remark about pointing your foot might have an emotional impact on you. It might confirm, you see, I'm not good at this, especially with feet and turnout. I notice this a lot. So those people have heard that as kids tend to clench their toes and do everything they can to pretend to have that foot, which they don't. But you could also just sit with them and go like, look, let's see what moves relative to what movement is available, and how can we get from your structure the most fluid and juicy movement available? And yes, so this is a big thing that if you use the same words over and over again, they might start getting a different meaning in the mind of the student. And you have to remember, people are in this world from very young until like in their 40s sometimes. And some cues we don't change. Pull up stays the same throughout the career. And what does that mean? It'd be so nice to find different wordings for it, or images, or just have a more diverse language so you can get the brain more stimulated into this, I think.
Yeah, definitely. And just jumping ahead a bit, I don't know if you're following our outline that we have, but I'm just going to jump ahead, because so something we spoke about a little bit when we were speaking about what we might cover today is about translating cues from children to adults and maybe the power. This is something that I love because I'm a teacher and I teach the best kids in the world, but in my opinion anyway. But they're so imaginative and creative, and they have so much to offer for their own training. So we were saying, what if children can like come up with the cues themselves, use their imagination to do this for what they need, how much that could enrich teaching as a profession. So instead of the things that we know, or we think we know, we need to say to get the results from our students, what if the students were coming up with these? And it's a much more, yeah, and then carry that all the way through to when they're older. And it could be a much more dynamic kind of career for us and a much more dynamic experience for them. I don't know if you have any comments on that.
Well, it's anyway a good idea to consider that kids have different brains than adults and very different bodies. And between 10 and 25, the body changes so many ways. So it would be a really good idea to adapt the language to that. And yes, I ask dancers often when, but I don't work with really little ones. So at the moment, I don't see kids that are younger than 16. But I ask them, like, so we work on, for instance, on turnout, and you feel, well, I feel much stronger. So now, can you find wordings for it? Can you label what you just did so that when you go into ballet class tomorrow and you think, I want to turn out, you can use your own label? And developing language like that and becoming more articulate like that will keep it all more alive and less repetitious and more dynamic, I hope. Yeah. I haven't researched this because I would love for you to come over and research if that actually is true. But that's my, I'm very interested. I'm curious to tickle their minds.
Yeah, totally. I love that. And that goes back to what you were saying as well, right at the start about the movement. It's movement. It's not being still. I can't remember what exactly you said.
It's both in Pilates and in dance training. There's a component of what we know what things should look like. And I started noticing that many times there's more emphasis on what needs to stay still, or maybe not more, but unnecessary amount of attention of what stays still as in relation to what moves. So I think we need to think more about what moves relative to what. And there is no such thing as holding things still in the body. It's constantly in movement. So whatever seems to be still probably moves in the opposite direction. And I started thinking about this a lot when I watched the ballet class with kids, and these kids were told by the teacher to hold their hips still in tendu. And as an adult, I understand what he means when he says, hold your hips still. But as they're kids, they were squeezing their bottoms together so tightly and holding their hips so still that the leg could not leave the hip socket. So they were just twisting the hips constantly, because the leg didn't move. So I was like, maybe we should emphasize that the leg moves in the hip socket more than the hips have to be still. And then we can do a playful anatomy thing, like, can you feel where that movement happens in the hip? And now squeeze your bottom, leg doesn't move. We don't need to release everything, but it doesn't help to squeeze that too tight. So I find it interesting. And I'd say when I teach non-professional movers Pilates, I try not to be so busy about holding things still.
Yeah, I know as well off that, it's not just the body that changes over time and needs new cues. The environment can change, the stage can change, people can change, their emotions can change. So that kind of dynamic relationship with coming up with new cues and keeping everything moving, the body and the mind, is so important for a dancer's career, I guess, and maybe makes their career more interesting, I suppose, if they're doing, I don't know, ballet's repetitive, and I guess if you're constantly coming up with new ways to think about it, that's got to be a good thing.
Yeah, I sometimes encourage the dancers to have a theme of the week or something, like, what else is it you want to work on? It's a very complex technique. The ballet technique is extremely intricate and complex, probably way more complex than any sport that I would know. So it takes a long time to figure it out. It's a it's an illusion that you'd figure that out during your dance training. I mean, you need those years afterwards to figure out how to manage yourself in a profession that is so demanding. And also the body is a very complex structure to understand. It probably takes more than one lifetime to understand your body. And then to combine those two, I remember in school, there was this girl and she was standing in front of a mirror and she kept saying, I hate my body. I hate my body. This is not good. This is not good. I remember thinking like, I'm not that pleased with my own body, but hating is not going to help. We still have to live in it. It's still our home. So how can we bridge that and from acceptance and from understanding the body as well as we can, instead of fighting it, from understanding we could achieve so much more and probably have a longer career too, because you probably last longer.
Yeah, totally. That makes me so sad when you say that. That just breaks my heart.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, there's a lot of great teaching out there. I'm certainly not suggesting that all the time we're, you know, leaving our kids in terrible hands. No, there's a lot of very, very good teaching, and it's just up to us to decide how we pass it on, this profession, right?
Yeah, and decide how we can keep it as something that everyone loves and doesn't have that kind of attached to it. On that note as well, so home training, and just taking home training for an example, students sometimes struggle with it because they go back to in class when they're told things are right or wrong, and this kind of fear of being wrong. How can simply noticing what's happening help them to do that? Because I think we mentioned that sometimes students don't always do the exercise they're given at home because they think, well, I'm doing it wrong, so like an absolutist mindset, I'm not going to do it at all. But what if
just
notice what was happening and then, yeah.
Well, when we talked about it afterwards, I thought like, it also reflects on me as a teacher, because I don't have that happen so much anymore. I had that happen a lot in the beginning. So probably in the beginning, I totally over-cued these dancers. So they thought, oh my God, this is way too complicated. I can never do this by myself. Because I don't have that happen so much anymore. Well, probably because I've decided to say more like, you do this exercise to gather information. So figure out what happens and just notice what happens when you're doing this, and then try it with a different breathing, or try it faster, or try it while lying on an unstable surface like a foam roller, and then just observe what happens and how does that inform you to something that you might want to do in your professional life. So I think that I thought back about it and I thought like that was part of me being inexperienced and trying to get everything to be precisely good. I can't do this online, but the quotes, but it's not that interesting of it, of doing something good. It's way more interesting in discovering different strategies that might open up movement facilities or possibilities that you hadn't expected.
Yeah, totally. That makes so much sense to me. I really hope that everyone else listening is getting the realization that I am, or maybe they already know this, but yeah, I'm just realizing so many things, and I'm thinking actually I don't do that at home because I'm worried I'll do it wrong, but maybe I should just notice what's happening and that would be a better approach.
Who's to say what is wrong?
Yeah.
I mean, if it breaks your leg, if it hurts you, it's wrong. But otherwise, it's just, it might be a little bit wonky or I don't know. But as long as you use it to inform yourself, that's not a bad thing.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. So hopefully by teaching students this now, so when you talk about when you work with your students in the school, sort of age 16, was it? How can this same concept, hopefully, if they learn to observe their bodies as opposed to be so critical, how do you think that this will empower them in the future? So as professionals, do you think they'll carry this forward? How do you think it will help them?
Well, yeah, I would like that to happen, but I don't know. I mean, I teach them in a group. Yesterday, I think 24 kids in a class, so that's a whole different thing. Sometimes, like once a week, some of them come to my studio, and then I have more time to work with them. And yes, of course, you'd hope for that to be something that they take on in life and that they remember. I hope what they take from it is, if they feel that something is difficult for them or that they cannot do something, that they're going to look for strategies to be able to open a movement up for them. And to not look for the perfection of it, but to look to essence. What is the essence of an arabesque? What's the essence of a developpe and or a plié? And that they allow themselves to step back and look again at it and dissect it maybe and see what element in that movement is difficult for me. And what in my backpack of exercises can I unpack and have analytical mind enough to understand how to approach it. And that their voice, their self-talk, their inner language, I really, really hope, and I have not that much control over that, but I really hope to contribute to that self-talk being positive. What can I do? So many corrections people tend to get in dance are about what they should not do. Don't do this, don't roll your feet, don't do this and that. And that never creates movement in us. Even when we sit and we think of all the things we shouldn't be doing, it doesn't make you want to move. It doesn't even want to leave your chair. So I think the more we focus on what we do want to happen, and I hope to install language in them like, but you do want to breathe, you do want to let your shoulder blades glide, and you do want to receive your weight when you come down in the plie. So you get those kind of language things that they can access and look for and recognize when instructions are not helpful and see if they can translate them into something that's actually helpful.
Yeah, totally. The thing, I don't know, some people watch it on YouTube, but most people can't see, but I'm just smiling so much because the thought of that makes, and I'm imagining if I went into class now thinking about all of those things about like for a plie, for example, it just sounds so enjoyable. Like the thought of just noticing and thinking, how could I make that happen? And what could I do? It just sounds like so much more enjoyable than thinking about all the things that are maybe right or wrong. And the idea as well, the other thing that comes to mind for me is how much growth there could be, like how much you could improve, mm-hmm. grow as a dancer when you're considering it like yes. that, as opposed to
I was working with a young woman this morning and she came to, I'd never seen her before. She came to me saying that her plie wasn't that deep enough. And I then you look, what do you do when you plie? And she was working so hard to get that plie to go. And then I just picked up anything I had at hand and I dropped it on the floor. I said, why do you think it fell down? So what gravity is? Well, plie is gravity. Don't work that hard. You're stopping it. You tense all your muscles in your foot. You cannot receive your weight. Plie is to land and to take out. It's like a trampoline. It spreads when you land and it contracts to push you back off again. And I see that more often, especially when you are very conscious about something that in you have received from your teachers as not being good enough. You're going to put in so much tension that you will not actually use that to the max. And I've seen that many times and it always makes me like you. It makes me sad because it's not necessary.
Yeah, definitely. And it's just the thought of, it's just exciting how much you could grow like from that as a dancer. There's two more things that I would love to look at today. So one of them, Catherine, who very, very kindly passed your contact on. Catherine, if you're listening, thank you so much. She praised your sort of holistic consideration of the dancer and their needs and all of their individual aspects. So the training environment, the movement specifics that they need to be able to achieve, maybe the repertoire they're studying at the moment. How does that mm-hmm. help you to shape a dancer's training at the time? Like, how do you specifically focus on those things? What do you change?
I build a relationship with dancers. You have to imagine some people I see over 12, 15 years, or I saw them already at school, and then I see them through three pregnancies. So you build a long relationship. I find it important to have a relationship of trust and openness. And so you are also there when people have highs in their careers, when they have lows in their careers, and you see them growing in that profession, which is one of the most beautiful things. The position I have, I always think is the best one, but I hope everybody has that feeling. But for me anyway, I love seeing how people grow and then they get challenges with new choreographers or a different stage or a new lift that is difficult, or they're working with a new person. And then we're going to make together, we're going to create exercises that meet their needs. Like, how will you ever be able to come down from that balance? It could be that specific. Or when the ballet is particularly hard for a lot of back extensions, what kind of recuperation program could we give you to do at the end of the day to restore, so you don't take that highly extended back into your evening and to bed? Or we make up something individual for somebody that does work suddenly that is very close to the floor and all the quads are burning. And like, so how could you do that? Integrating maybe more your hamstrings or your inner legs or your core. I love doing that. It's really fun. And clearly here, it's nice to work with people that are also creative, because they come up with stuff that I didn't come up with, but then I can teach that to other people who are really benefiting from that. So it opens up the approach also, which I really, really like. And the other thing is, Jasmine, when you see these people, they often, especially pre-pandemic, they would be performing 3 or 4 ballets, like triple bills, prepare for a tour and rehearse something else in the middle. So every hour their body is doing something often completely opposite, different dynamic movement, different rehearsal, different music, different partnering. And every hour a new thing gets layered on, and I started getting a feedback from one dancer and that it helps to do Pilates to just come back to yourself in all that hectic. And I was thinking of, like, if as a dancer you were an empty canvas, which clearly you're not because you bring your personality and your body, but if that was an empty canvas, then every choreographer is going to paint their painting on top of each other, right? So it becomes a big model of where your body is in space anymore. So sometimes it's just that doing simple breathing, the simplest exercises to land back and feel what your body feels like after all these storms, and then prepare for the next day of more storms, clearly. So that it's nice because it makes this different than just teaching Pilates, yeah. For sure. It opens up different things.
No, totally. And I like personally think that's just as important as any exercise that you can give someone is coming back to yourself, because I hadn't ever thought about it like that. That's such a good kind of image to give, an analogy of the canvas. And it would just be a big muddle. And I think, yeah, and then the next day is another muddle, and then the next day is another muddle. And then, yeah, I think that's the coming back to yourself, that recovery aspect is just as important as, yeah, carrying on and learning how to kind of, yeah, the movement side of it as well. The very last, I could talk to you forever, but the very last kind of area that I want to touch on, which is going right back to the start, but when you started sort of teaching Pilates in a professional ballet company, you mentioned that was when you started presenting at iAdams with a group of other Pilates teachers in dance companies who you met through that. What did you kind of look at? What did you all discuss that was similar or different between your work?
Well, it was great. It was Jane Paris, the Pilates teacher from Royal Ballet, who had the opportunity to go to many, many iAdamses because the company supported her through that. And every time she came in different cities meeting other Pilates teachers, and then she brought us all together. So we were Barbara Harris from Boston, Clarice Marshall from New York, Paula Bickold from Australia, and then Jane and me. And it was so nice to be with people that you could talk in full confidentiality about our positioning, because you have to imagine we're in this sort of crossroad at this intersection between the health team and your artistic staff. We're all also ballet teachers. We've also all taught ballet, so that helps. So we're in that intersection, and we're not paramedical trained. We're not ballet staff, but we do sit in that intersection, and it's a very sensitive place. You get a lot of very sensitive information, and how you deal with the information that comes at you and how you deal with that dancer and how you make them feel safe is very important. So it's great to have people that do a similar job to talk to about this. And even through the pandemic, I mean, we first met each other in 2008, and we're still in contact, and we've through the pandemic shared experiences there. And from that came the idea to them do a presentation at iAdams, which we did in 2009, and I think one in 2012 and 14, I don't know. It was The Hague, Basel, and Pittsburgh. First one was about the role of the Pilates teacher, and then we did one about arabesque, all the different elements of arabesque, and how we each approach that. So it's the position of the foot, lower leg, be the control of turnout, it would be the thoracic mobility, it would be the hip extension, and what kind of exercises would we give, and all together that would compose into an arabesque, which was a really fun presentation. And the last one in Pittsburgh, we actually did a demonstration with a dancer from Pittsburgh Ballet, and each of us taught her a couple of things where we showed that, because it's a misconception that when you work with dancers, you're going to do all this acrobatic wild stuff, which often my Pilates colleagues tend to think. But instead, you're working on this incredible detail. You just zooming in. Then you zoom out again. Then you zoom in, So you're not doing anything wild at all, but you're just getting like this really nerdy about little things and being thrilled together that they make such big changes. So it's more of that. But I'm not sure if I answered your full question. But so after the third eye items, we didn't do it anymore because it's a costly thing also. It takes a lot of time and effort.
Yeah, no, that's so interesting. And I love that. So you zoom in and then, I really like that as well. What did you all find was kind of similar or different between your like different companies and different experiences? Is it just being in that kind of intersection you could all relate, or?
That intersection definitely was something that, because we talked about it, we became so aware of it. Differences, too many to say. Also, most of our companies went through multiple changes of directors, which clearly makes it a continuous. Fortunately, it's good that companies change directors because it keeps the windows open and the wind blow through, right? Our companies all have very different rep. So we weren't that busy at looking at difference. We were really happy with finding similarities. And often when dancers traveled between our companies, that was nice because we could be in touch about that dancer. And sometimes Clarice from New York would come to Holland and see some of her students from the school perform here. And so it's more that we weren't so much looking at the differences.
Yeah, no, that's so lovely. Leila, it's been so great to chat to you today. Thank you so much for your time. Is there anything else you'd like to mention or discuss before we go?
Well, yes, because you give me this opportunity to say this. I think dance is it's such a beautiful art form, right? I mean, there's a hugely athletic component to it, but I don't think it's a sport. I think it's an art form. And it's such a beautiful art form. And we've all been passed this art form by our own teachers, right? And if we make a bit of an effort, we can trace our beginnings from our teachers to the beginning of ballet, right? It's something that we pass on with our hands. It's not something you learn online. So I just find that in passing this on to the next generation, we need to make every effort to invite the next generation to be part of it, invite them to be in it, and to find it interestingly enough that they want to pass it on to the generation after. It's a precious and vulnerable art form. And I think every generation has to make its own choices how to pass it on and keep it alive. So traditions also need to evolve. They have evolved forever, always. So they still also in dance evolve.
Yeah.
So that would be the art form itself, I'm happy to serve it when I teach.
Yeah.
And that's basically what I do.
Yeah, that's perfect, Leila. Thank you so much for that. I can leave your contact details in the show notes below if anyone's interested in reaching out to chat further, if that's okay with you. But yeah, apart from that, that's all. Thank you so much for your time, Leila. It's been so great to chat.
Thank you, Jasmine. Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thanks so much for listening. Tune in again next Monday. And in the meantime, follow at @SideDancePodcast on Instagram. It would also be so appreciated if you have a moment, if you could please rate and review on Apple to help the podcast grow. Bye.